They say the gods were born already holding hands. In the velvet dark of Nut's star-strewn womb, Isis and Osiris fell in love before they ever drew a breath of earthly air. They were the golden children of the Aeneid, destined to rule the Remic Kemet, the people of the Black Land. Together, they turned the Nile Valley into a paradise of green shoots, sweet water, and shared laughter. But every kingdom casts a shadow. Beyond the fertile stretch lay the Red Land, the barren, choking desert. And there sat Set. Set's rule was as dry as the sands he oversaw, matched only by his passionless union to his sister Nephthys, the goddess of the night. It was a cold marriage made frozen when Nephthys, harboring a secret, aching love for Osiris, disguised herself as Isis and lay with the sun god. From that stolen quiet night, the jackal-headed Anubis was born. The betrayal was an unexpected shattering blow. When Set discovered the truth, a dark, quiet fury took root in his chest, made a couple, overshadowed, and drowning in envy. Set realized that to steal Osiris's throne, he had to strike before his brother could sire a legitimate heir with Isis. He chose a public festival for the slaughter, the last place that anyone would look for death. The court was a dizzying blur of gold, fine white cotton, and absolute joy. Osiris and Isis sat royally upon their thrones, laughing easily. Behind Set stood Nephthys, placing a tentative pleading hand on her husband's shoulder. Set winced, his jaw tightening in disgust. Isis, in her infinite grace, had already forgiven her sister, so why couldn't he? But Set masked his rage beneath a hollow smile. Around them, the high society of Egypt feasted. The air was heavy and pungent with the scent of roasted duck, stews laced with garlic, sticky honeyed dates, and warm coriander bread. Courtiers drank deeply of beer, dancing as collars of fresh lily flowers swung around their necks to the sweet melancholy strumming of lutes and harps. Feigning a jovial, steady temperament, Set stood up and clapped his hands, capturing the room. With a flourish, his servants brought forth an intricately carved chest, placing it in the dead center of the court. Weeks prior, Set had secretly hired the finest craftsmen to build it, painting it in the rarest, most prized shade of deep Egyptian blue. "A game," Set announced, his voice booming over the music. "Whoever fits perfectly inside this chest shall keep it as a gift." The guests laughed, trying and failing one by one, treating it as splendid holiday fun. Naive to the venom brewing in his brother's chest, Osiris waited until the very end to participate. With a carefree smile, the king stepped down from his throne and climbed into the blue box. He laid flat, his eyes shifting upward to meet Set's gaze. Osiris smiled, believing he had won the game. High on her dais, Isis applauded her husband. Her heart was light. And then the music stopped. Like a sudden blinding flash of lightning, Set's minions rushed to the floor. High-ranking officials were violently shoved aside. Nobles were forced to their knees. Before Osiris could comprehend the shift, the heavy lid was slammed shut over his face, plunging him into pitch darkness. The heavy bronze locks clicked into place with a sickening final sound. Tragically, the exterior of the chest was gilded with the image of Nut, her outstretched body hugging what had just unexpectedly become her son's coffin. A collective gasp tore through the court. Isis lunged from her throne, a scream freezing in her throat, but she was too late. The heavy box was carried out into the night and cast ruthlessly into the rushing current of the night, left to drown in the deep. The kingdom fell silent under Set's new tyrannical rule. Horrified by the monster her husband had become, Nephthys fled the court, joining a broken, weeping Isis. Together, the two sisters became wandering ghosts upon the earth, their laments echoing across the sands. When they finally located the chest washed ashore, the sorrows deepened. Opening it revealed the cold, rotted corpse of the king they both loved. Hoping against hope, they brought the body to Thoth and Anubis to see if divine medicine could spark life back into the blue flesh. But Set's cruelty knew no baseline. learning of the recovery, he sent his executioners to steal the body back. In a frantic act of desecration, they sliced Osiris's corpse into 42 jagged pieces, scattering them across the provinces of Egypt. Secure in his own tyranny, Set paid no mind to the weeping widow. He ruled blindly, entirely unaware that Isis, aided by the mourning Nephthys, the loyal Anubis, and wise Thoth, was quietly crawling through the dirt, gathering the severed pieces of her husband. Once found, Anubis and Thoth wrapped the body in linen, creating the first mummy. Isis then used her magic to perform the forbidden rite. She altered her form, transforming into a kite, a weeping bird of prey. Spreading her feathered wings over the reconstructed stitched corpse of her husband, she let out a piercing, haunting cry that tore through the veil of life and death. I am your sister whom you loved upon earth. You shall not be far from me. Awake, Osiris. Raise yourself up. The magic took hold. Beneath her, Osiris's eyes fluttered open, his cold body stitching together into a fragile wholeness. Hovering above him in bird form, Isis fanned her wings, breathing her own life force directly into his mouth. In that brief, beautiful, and deeply melancholic transition between the worlds, they copulated one last time, the living bird and the reanimated dead, impregnating Isis with their avenging son, Horus. But magic has its limits, and the universe demanded balance. Osiris couldn't remain in the sunlit world of the living. As the spell waned, his spirit slipped away from Isis's touch, descending forever into the gray mists of the Duat. He became the lord of the underworld, forever the king of the dead, while his queen remained alone in the land of the living, left to raise a son in the shadow of a love that traversed the grave. Before we can understand the goddess Isis, we need to understand the world that created her. Ancient Egypt was one of the longest-lasting civilizations in human history, enduring for more than 3,000 years. Across those centuries, dynasties rose and fell, capitals shifted, and foreign empires came and went. Yet one fundamental idea remained remarkably consistent. The universe was alive. To the ancient Egyptians, the world wasn't a collection of separate objects. The Nile, the stars, the desert, the sun, birth, death, kingship, and magic were all woven together into a living sacred order. The gods weren't these distant beings standing outside of creation. They were the powers operating within it, sustaining reality itself. At the heart of Egyptian religion stood a concept known as Maat. Maat was the underlying principle that held the universe together. It governed the movement of the stars, the flooding of the Nile, the legitimacy of kings, and the moral responsibilities of human beings. Opposing Maat was Isfet, the force of chaos, disorder, violence, and dissolution. To the ancient Egyptians, the world was a fragile island of order surrounded by an infinite ocean of primordial chaos. Every day, the forces of order had to be renewed, and they had to be defended against the constant pressure of disorder. That primordial chaos was known as Nun, or the dark, limitless waters that existed before creation even began. According to the most influential Egyptian creation tradition, the one preserved in the city of Heliopolis, the first being to emerge from Nun was the creator god Atum. Rising upon the first mount of dry land, Atum brought forth the first generation of gods, Shu, the god of air, and Tefnut, the goddess of moisture. From Shu and Tefnut came Geb, the earth, and Nut, the sky, and from Geb and Nut came four divine siblings whose story would shape Egyptian religion for many millennia: Osiris, Isis, Set, and Nephthys. These gods formed the central drama of Egyptian mythology. Osiris became the divine king associated with fertility, death, and resurrection. Set embodied storms, disorder, and destructive force. Nephthys occupied the liminal spaces of magic, mourning, and protection, and Isis stood among them as one of the most powerful and beloved deities in Egyptian history. Isis belonged to the very heart of Egypt's sacred family tree. But to really appreciate why Isis became so important, we have to understand another distinctive feature of Egyptian religion, their understanding of the soul, death, and eternal life. The Egyptians believed that a human being was composed of multiple spiritual dimensions. The Ka was the life force that animated the body. The Ba was the individual's personality and consciousness, capable of traveling between worlds after death. And the Ah was the final transformed state, an immortal luminous spirit achieved when the soul successfully passed through the trials of the afterlife. This fascination with death emerged from the Egyptian conviction that life moved in cycles. The sun died every evening and was reborn every morning. The Nile retreated and returned. The crops withered and they grew again. Nothing truly ended and everything transformed. To the ancient Egyptians, the landscape of Egypt was a conscious physical mirror of the divine architecture of the heavens. Reality was divided strictly along the axis of the Nile River. First, you have the Kemet, or the Black Land. This was the fertile dark silt brought by the annual flooding of the Nile. It was the realm of life, agriculture, villages, temples, and the living. It was under the direct protective jurisdiction of Horus. And then you have the Deseret, or the Red Land. This was the barren, scorching desert that pressed against the valley walls on both sides. It was the realm of chaos, wild animals, foreign invaders, and nomadic tribes. The Western concept of linear time, which is moving from a beginning toward a distinct end, was fundamentally foreign to the Egyptians. Instead, they viewed time as an intertwining of two distinct eternal temporal dimensions. Nehe was considered cyclical time. This was time manifest through change, recurrence, and natural rhythms. It was symbolized by the daily journey of the sun god Ra across the sky, the cyclical phases of the moon, and the annual predictable flooding of the Nile. Nehe was a constant process of death and rebirth, ensuring that creation was continuously rejuvenated. And then you had Jet, or linear or static eternity. This was the time of completion, stability, and absolute permanence. It was the temporal dimension inhabited by Osiris, the dead, the mummies, and the pyramids. Jet is the past completely realized, frozen in a state of unchangeable perfection. Every day, the universe participated in both dimensions. As the sun rose, Nehe, it broke out of the static perfection of the underworld, Jet, ensuring that reality was both securely rooted in an unchangeable past and dynamically renewed every single morning. This cyclical understanding of existence found its greatest expression in the story of Osiris and Isis, a myth of death, grief, magic, resurrection, and rebirth that would become one of the most influential sacred narratives of the ancient world. And at the center of the story stood Isis herself, magician, mourner, healer, queen, and ultimately one of the most powerful goddesses of the ancient world. Isis, or Aset, first appears in the Old Kingdom, which is around 2686 to 2181 BC. She first appears in the Pyramid Texts, which were compiled during the 5th and 6th dynasties. The Pyramid Texts are the oldest surviving body of ancient Egyptian religious and funerary writings. This collection of magical spells, hymns, and prayers were carved onto the interior walls of royal pyramids at Saqqara to protect the pharaoh in his afterlife and help him ascend to the heavens. In the Pyramid Texts, Isis appears not as an omnipotent universal mother, but as a core member of the Heliopolitan Ennead, the group of the nine foundational creator deities. She is introduced systematically as the daughter of Geb and Nut, the sister and loyal wife of Osiris, the sister of Set and Nephthys, and the biological mother of Horus. Her name itself, Aset, literally translates to throne or seat. In her earliest textual appearances, she is the literal symbolic seat of power. She represents the physical throne upon which the living king sits, making her the ultimate kingmaker. So what is her role in these texts? The primary reason Isis is summoned in the Pyramid Texts is to address the crisis of Osiris' murder by his brother Set. Isis, alongside her sister Nephthys, is assigned the role of the archetypal weeping widow and professional mourner. In the Pyramid Texts, she tracks down the broken or dead body of the king, laments over him, and uses her presence to prevent his flesh from decaying. She acts as a cosmic reassembler of the Shattered King. If we refer to the Pyramid Text Utterance 532, it reads the following. Isis comes, Nephthys comes, one of them from the right, one of them from the left. They find Osiris, his brother Set having thrown him to the ground and netted. Once she locates the deceased king, Isis uses physical proximity and vocalized magic to reverse death. In early texts, she is beautifully contextualized using navel and elemental metaphors. She is the one who moors the dead king back to life so that his soul doesn't drift away into the chaotic void. She is described as physically interacting with the mummy to breathe vitality back into him through the beating of her wings. Here in the text, Utterance 366 reads the following. Your sister Isis comes to you rejoicing for love of you. You have placed her on your phallus, and your seed goes into her. She acts for you as Isis, prevented you from rotting. Isis laments for you. Nephthys calls out to you. Arise, for your sister Isis has gathered your flesh. Because the living king of Egypt was viewed as the god Horus on earth, and the deceased king became Osiris, Isis is established as the divine mother of the reigning pharaoh. Her role is to nurse, feed, and spiritually shield the king as he ascends to the stars. The texts routinely show Isis giving her breast to the ascending king to grant him divine mortality. If we refer to Pyramid Text Utterance 470, it reads the following. The king has come to his mother, the sky goddess. He has come to Isis. She gives him her breast and he sucks it. Isis will suckle you. Nephthys will nurse you. You shall not fall. You shall not perish. From the Pyramid Text, we learn that Isis is portrayed as a deeply empathetic deity who experiences raw human grief, making her really relatable. She is the pivot of continuity. Without her, the cycle of kingship breaks. She bridges the gap between the dead king, who is Osiris, and the living king, Horus. She is the master of transition. Her words and physical actions possess the intrinsic power to reverse the physical entropic forces of decay, which is known as Isfet, establishing her from the very dawn of written history as Egypt's ultimate protectress and life-giver. During the Old Kingdom, Isis had not yet evolved into the universal cross-cultural mother goddess that she would later become. In her earliest cult, she was closely tied to kingship, the elite, and the afterlife, rendering her most visible within royal funerary religion through the Pyramid Texts and through elite tomb inscriptions, where her primary mythological role was to mourn, protect, and magically restore the deceased king as Osiris. While the sparse archaeological record doesn't completely rule out popular devotion amongst the common populace, it demonstrates that her influence was initially anchored within the structural matrix of the palace and the royal tomb. However, as beliefs regarding resurrection and the afterlife began to democratize over the centuries, her protective power expanded to the masses, setting the historical stage for her dramatic rise as one of the most widely beloved and dominant deities of the ancient Mediterranean world. For centuries, Isis stood beside the throne of kings, but during the Middle Kingdom, she stepped beyond the walls of the palace and into the hopes, fears, and spiritual imagination of ordinary Egyptians. This was a period of profound religious change. The promise of resurrection was no longer reserved exclusively for the pharaoh. Increasingly, common people sought the same eternal destiny that was once claimed only by royalty. And as those hopes expanded, so did the importance of Isis. Much of what we know about the transformation of Isis comes from the Coffin Texts, a vast collection of funerary writings that reveal a goddess whose powers were becoming more intimate, more accessible, and more universal. The Coffin Texts allowed ordinary citizens, wealthy nobles, and high-ranking officials to have these sacred spells painted directly onto the interiors of their wooden coffins, ensuring that anyone who could afford them could achieve immortality in the afterlife. Because the path to paradise was heavily modeled on the journey of Osiris, Isis plays a vital, expanded, and highly personal role within these spells. The texts explicitly define who she is, expand her mythological capabilities, and reveal her as an intimate protectress and life giver. In the coffin texts, Isis's identity expands from being just a member of the cosmic Aeneid, a powerful magician, and the ultimate archetype of maternal devotion. She is introduced and explicitly identified as the loving sister-wife of Osiris, the divine partner who refuses to abandon her husband in death, the sister and spiritual double of the deceased. Because ordinary individuals now become an Osiris upon death, Isis was explicitly claimed by the common dead as their personal sister, the mother of the hidden falcon Horus, the fierce protector of the divine lineage, and the great mooring post. In a boat-infused Egyptian culture, coming to a moor was a euphemism for death. Isis is identified as the cosmic mooring post who safely anchors the soul into the harbor of the afterlife so it doesn't drift away into chaos. In the coffin text, Isis is the reassembler of the dead. Building upon her earlier mythological motifs, the coffin text presents Isis as a hands-on active healer who physically pieces together the decaying bones of the deceased to end the state of death. In these texts, she and her sister Nephthys travel to the underworld to manipulate the physical form of the mummy using vocalized incantations to knit the body back together. If we refer to spell 74, which is a spell for the revival of Osiris, it reads the following: Ah, helpless one, ah, helpless one, asleep, behold, I have found you lying on your side, the great listless one. Ah, sister, says Isis to Nephthys, this is our brother. Come, let us lift up his head. Come, let us rejoin his bones. Come, let us reassemble his limbs. Come, let us put an end to all his woe. Given that Isis is referred to as a magician in the coffin text, it's important to discuss what Heka is. In ancient Egyptian cosmology, Heka is the foundational generative force of magic that underpins the entire universe. It's not viewed as a supernatural disruption of natural laws or a human manipulation of reality as magic is often defined today. Heka is the very energy that makes the laws of nature function. It is the primordial power through which creation was catalyzed, Maat or cosmic order is maintained, and the gods execute their wills. The word Heka is written in hieroglyphs with a symbol depicting a twist of flax or a pair of upraised embracing arms, often paired with a striking cobra or a sacrificial front leg of an ox, signifying action, empowerment, and authoritative speech. To understand how Heka operates, Egyptian theology couples it with two other divine concepts, which is Sia, or the perception of intellect, and Hu, or authoritative utterance. So first, a deity uses Sia to conceptualize an idea in the heart. And next, the deity speaks that thought aloud into the universe using Hu. Finally, Heka acts as the magical conductor or the energy that physicalizes the spoken word into material reality. Because of this linguistic foundation, Heka is fundamentally bound to the spoken word. It's bound to the ritual text and the physical symbols. It is a creative, protective, and defensive force that was practiced by the gods, pharaohs, and ordinary citizens alike to ward off chaos, which is Isfet, but also to ward off diseases, to cure diseases, and ensure safe passage into the afterlife. This foundational understanding of Heka illuminates why Isis occupies such a pivotal role in the Osiris myth cycle. When Osiris is murdered and dismembered, his restoration is achieved not through brute physical strength, but through the esoteric power of knowledge, ritual, and sacred speech. Utilizing her absolute mastery of this primordial energy, Isis gathers the scattered limbs of her husband, speaks the precise words of power, and temporarily revives him, an act of magical animation that makes possible both the conception of Horus and the seamless continuation of divine earthly kingship. So in this manner, Isis transcends her role as a mere participant in the drama to become the living embodiment of Hecate itself, a supreme goddess whose wisdom, unyielding devotion, and magical authority successfully overcome the entropic forces of death and disorder. By possessing the exact words that awaken life, the structural formulas that protect the traveling soul, and the sacred knowledge required for order or mat to triumph over chaos or Isfet, she emerges in the coffin text not merely as a grieving wife and protective mother, but as the ultimate divine magician whose transcendent wisdom can actively reverse death itself. While this immense magical authority established Isis as a master over death, her Heka wasn't practiced in isolation. Rather, it served as the vital protective foundation for her defining role as a mother. Her role as cosmic magician and fierce mother becomes particularly vivid in the Middle Kingdom's coffin text, most notably in her first-person perspective while pregnant with Horus. As seen in Spell 148, she declares that her unborn son will grow strong to avenge his father and overthrow Set. It reads the following: "What he shall rule is this land and the heritage of his father Geb. I am Isis, one more spirit-like and august than the gods. The god is within this womb of mine, and he is the seed of Osiris." In the coffin text, Isis is warned to keep her pregnancy a closely guarded secret, anticipating that her son Horus would ultimately avenge his father's murder and strip the throne from the usurper Set. It says the following: "If you are pregnant, then conceal this from the gods, and that the seed of Osiris is he, lest the enemy who slew his father shall come and break the egg in its early stages, the one whom the great of magic is afraid." So what exactly happens after Isis becomes pregnant with Horus? The water here doesn't flow. It stagnates. It's thick, heavy, and choked with the black silt of the delta. With every breath, the stench of rotting vegetation fills my throat, but I don't dare move. I must remain as still as the stone statues of my ancestors. In my arms, Horus begins to shift. I press him closer to my chest, my heart hammering against his tiny ribs, praying to the cosmos that he will not cry. A single whimper, a solitary splash, and the hunters will find us. Around my head, a cloud of mosquitoes buzzes in a maddening, relentless swarm. They bite at my face, my arms, my eyes, but I cannot swat them away. To raise a hand is to risk a sound, and to make a sound is to wake my child and invite the wrath of the usurper. The Egyptian sun is a merciless executioner today, beating heavily down upon the back of my neck. I look down at my sweet boy. His delicate skin is seared red, blistered by the brutal assault of the midday rays. "Just 10 more paces," I whisper into the silence of my mind. 10 more steps through this liquid mud to reach dry land. 10 steps to the shade of the tamarisk trees, where the air might finally become bearable. But I do not walk alone. In the shadows of the reeds, 7 pairs of ancient gleaming eyes keep watch. They are my vanguard, my silent protectors against the murderous gaze of my brother Set. They are the scorpions of the goddess Serket. "Go!" I breathe a sound no louder than the rustle of dry papyrus. Instantly, Tetet, Djet, and Matet glide forward. They slip through the murky water ahead of me, scouting the path to ensure that no ambush awaits the rightful heir to the throne. To my right and left, Mestet and Mesetet flank my body, their pincers raised, snapping at the empty air, keeping a vigilant watch. And behind us, guarding our vulnerable rear, tread Tefen and Befen, the most fierce and ruthless of the 7. A sharp rhythmic clicking echoes through the starks. The signal. It's all clear. Lifting my feet with agonizing care so as not to stir the swamp, I step out of the dirty water, We break through the edge of the marsh, finally collapsing into the cool offering shade of the trees. "Stay with him," I command the seven, laying my sleeping horse upon a bed of soft moss beneath the roots. "Guard his breath. I must go into town to beg for alms." With a tremor of Heka, I let my divine radiance bleed away. My smooth skin withers into deep wrinkles. My regal spine bends under the weight of feigned decades. I clothe myself in tattered, dust-caked rags of a helpless, destitute old woman. Accompanied by my deadly bodyguard, I hobble past the gates of the local village. We tread down the dusty main street. The heat is radiating off the mud brick walls. I look up. At a grand upper window stands a noble woman. Her hair is styled in elaborate perfume braids. Her linen shift is stark white against the terracotta sun. Our eyes meet. I extend a trembling, hollow palm upward. With a sneer of absolute disgust, she turns her nose to the sky. She slams her heavy wooden door shut, the strike of the bolt echoing like a slap through the street. Beneath my cloak, the earth begins to vibrate. The seven are incensed. I can hear their furious hissing, their tails whipping against the dirt in a synchronized dance of pure malice. They are crafting a dark retribution. In the shadows, the scorpions gather. One by one, they deliberately raise their stingers and surrender their venom, draining their own reservoirs to pour it all into a single vessel. Tefen. He draws the collective lethal concoction up into his bulbous stinger, his armor gleaming like obsidian as he waits for the cover of night. But as I stand rejected in the dirt, a gentle hand touches my withered shoulder. "Mother," a soft voice says. I turn to see a young peasant woman. Her skin is deeply sunburned from long hours in the fields, and her lips are dry and cracked from the desert wind, yet her eyes are wide with kindness. "You and your companions look spent. Please, come under my roof. I have only a simple meal, but it's yours." Inside the peasant's humble hut, the air is cool. She sets down a meager plate and we sit together, nibbling on small pieces of dry breadcrumbs. But outside, the shadows are moving. Tefen slips out from beneath my cloak. He creeps across the dusty road, a silent executioner sliding beneath the grand bolted door of the noblewoman's estate. He marks his target, the lady's young son, a boy with smooth bronze skin dressed in the finest Egyptian cotton. With a strike as swift as lightning, Tefen drives his stinger deep into the boy's leg, emptying the combined venom of seven gods into his veins. The boy collapses into a horrific stupor. "Heppy, wake up! Look at me!" the noblewoman screams, her voice piercing the evening air. She grabs his limp body, shaking him, breathing desperately into his mouth, but her breath is useless against the fire of the poison. Horrified, her face is stained with tears and her mind crazed with panic, she stumbles out into the streets. She can barely stand, wailing to the heavens, begging anyone, mortal or divine, for a cure. But the villagers only look on in helpless terror. Inside the hut, I pause, a breadcrumb resting on my fingertip. I turn my head toward the open doorway, watching the frantic broken woman collapse into the dirt. My scorpions look up at me, their tails are twitching in triumph. "She got what she deserved," their movements say. But as I look at her distraught, shaking form, the vengeful goddess within me softens, and the mother awakens. I know that terror. I know the agonizing fear of holding a dying son in the marshes, helpless against the dark. Compassion, fierce and sudden, begins to flood my heart. "Come," I say to the peasant girl, casting off my disguise as I stand. I stride into the grand house of the noblewoman. The seven scorpions are tailing in my wake like a royal court. The dying boy lies on a gilded cedar bed, his skin turning a sickly ash gray. I step forward and lift him into my arms, pressing my hands against the burning wound. I close my eyes and my voice shifts, resonating with the ancient power that shaped the primeval mound. To control the poison, I must dominate its creators. Hetet, Hetet, Matet, I call out, invoking their secret primordial names into the room. The air grows thick with Heka. Mezatet, Meztet, Tefin, Befin. With each secret name uttered, the scorpions bow their heads to the floor. Their power is neutralized. Their malice is bound to my absolute will. I begin to weave the incantations of great magic, formulas known only to me, whispered to my heart by the Creator himself. Flow out, poison of the earth, disperse from the limbs of this child, for I am Isis, the great of magic, whose utterance removes suffering. Slowly, a visible mist begins to evaporate from the boy's bronze skin. The angry black veins on his legs begin to recede, fading back into healthy flesh. The fire inside him dies. Suddenly, the young boy draws a long gasping breath. His eyes snap wide, clear and bright, as if he had temporarily eclipsed the dark halls of the Duat and been dragged back to the land of the living by his very own soul. The noble woman gasps. She doesn't look at my tattered clothes anymore. She sees the blinding solar majesty of the goddess standing in her throne. Falling directly to her knees in the dirt, her nose pressed to the floorboards, she weeps tears of intense, breathless gratitude. Forgive me, great one, she sobs, her voice trembling with profound shame. I was blind. I was cruel. She rises slowly, grabbing chest after chest of her finest gold, her costliest linens, and her wealthiest treasures, dragging them to the center of the room. Take it, she begs, bowing to me and then to the stunned peasant woman standing by the door. Take everything I own. Let my wealth honor the goddess who gives breath to the dead and the sister who offered her bread when I offered only iron. I look at the peasant woman, then back to the boy resting peacefully in his mother's arms. I smile, the shadows of the Delta marshes finally fading from my mind. Sovereignty, I whisper, turning back toward the quiet reeds where my own son waits, is not inherited by brute strength. It's won through the heart. In this swampy sanctuary, Isis kept Horus's existence a closely guarded secret, pouring all her love and resourcefulness into her survival. As an infant hidden in the marshes, Horus was constantly exposed to the dangers of the swamp, suffering numerous venomous bites from snakes and scorpions. The famous Metternich stela captures a strikingly tender and vulnerable moment in Egyptian myth, showing Isis experiencing the raw universal fear of any human mother who is terrified of losing her child. According to the text, she first ran to the local women of the Delta, begging for a cure. It was only when human medicine failed that Thoth, the god of wisdom, descended to teach Isis the high magical formulas needed to save her son. Armed with this divine insight, Isis didn't just save Horus. She extended this protective shield to all of humanity, using her words to heal mortal children in similar danger by declaring the following. Every reptile with stings listens to me. Isis, great of magic before the gods, has spoken to whom Geb has given his magic to repulse poison. The narrative continues as Isis brings Horus out of hiding to present him to the divine court. According to the stela of Amun-Mose, she is the one who suckled the child in solitude, no one knew where, who brought him when his arms were strong into the hall of Geb, causing the Aeneid to rejoice. Welcome Osiris's son, Horus, stout of heart justified, son of Isis, heir of Osiris. Yet despite this divine welcome, Horus's path to the throne would prove quite treacherous. This legal gridlock is explored deeply in the contendings of Horus and Set, which is known as the Papyrus Chesterbeating. Believed to originate from the sacred scribal circles of Deir el-Medina, The text opens during a ceasefire where both sides argue their case before the Aeneid. Isis fully expected her son to be crowned without question, and when the gods hesitated, she vocally disrupted the trial. Enraged, Set demanded the court move to a remote island, explicitly ordering the god Nemti to deny Isis any entry. But bars could not hold a goddess of Hecate. Disguising herself as an elderly woman, Isis tricked Nemti by trading a signet ring for passage across the river. Once on the island, she transformed herself into a beautiful young woman, utterly disarming Set. Blinded by her beauty, Set listened to her tell a story of a herdsman's son whose inheritance had been illegally seized by an outsider. When Set righteously declared that the thief should be beaten and the property returned, Isis revealed her true identity. By defending the fictional son, Set had accidentally confessed to his own guilt, an admission so absolute that even Ra could no longer deny it. With Set's legal defense shattered, the divine dispute shifted from the courtroom to the battlefield, escalating into a series of brutal physical competitions. True to his destiny, Horus bested his uncle at every turn, but the heaviest blow of the entire 80-year war would not be dealt by Set. It would be struck on a muddy riverbank, born from a mother's mercy and a son's blinding rage. The water of the marsh settled dark and heavy, concealing the ancient, desperate, shape-shifting war of hippopotamuses beneath its surface. On the bank stood Isis, her knuckles white around her magical harpoon. Her first strike bit deep, but the agonizing cry that echoed up through the reeds was the voice of her own son. "Mother!" Horus screamed. Shaking, she recalled the magic. Her second strike found its mark, piercing Set. But as her treacherous brother wept, begging her by the blood of their shared mother, Isis's fiercely maternal heart fractured. She couldn't execute her own kin in cold blood, so she released the spear. When Horus breached the surface, his eyes were not those of a prince, but of a cornered beast. The betrayal burned hotter than Set's poison. In a flash of bronze and blinding fury, his cleaver caught the light. A single terrible strike severed the head of the Great of Magic. Silence fell over the delta, broken only by the heavy panting of a son who had just committed the ultimate taboo. Horus fled into the jagged shadows of the mountain wastes, cradling his grim trophy, blinded by his own righteous wrath. When Thoth's quiet incantations finally mended her, replacing her lost visage with the gentle horned crown of the celestial cow, Isis opened her eyes. She didn't curse the boy hiding in the desert caves. She knew the crushing weight of the crown that he fought for. She knew the madness that ancestral trauma could inflict upon the young. Touching her new brow, her resolve only hardened. He was wild. He was broken. And he had struck her down. But he was still her boy, the rightful heir of Osiris, and she would move heaven and earth until he sat upon his father's throne. True to his destiny, Horus ended up besting his uncle at every turn, successfully vindicating his father and claiming his rightful place as king. By the new kingdom, Isis is firmly established as a divine healer and master of Hecate, sacred power through speech, knowledge, and ritual. She is also one of the most important figures in the mythology of death and resurrection, not as a ruler of the underworld, but as the goddess who restores life, reassembles what is broken, and ensures the dead can be reborn into the afterlife. Isis gains immense magical authority in the secret name of Ra, which is one of the most famous mythological narratives from ancient Egypt, primarily preserved in the New Kingdom Turin magical papyrus. The myth is a masterclass in the execution of Heka, demonstrating that in the Egyptian cosmos, true power over a being is achieved not through physical dominance, but through the esoteric knowledge of their hidden primordial name. In the oldest days of the sun, when Ra still ruled from his throne of light, even the great god was not untouched by time. He had grown older, not in years as mortals know them, but in the slow erosion that even divine radiance cannot resist. His limbs carried the weight of creation itself, and his breath, once the force that set the worlds into motion, now sometimes faltered. He sat upon his earthly throne, still luminous, still sovereign, yet no longer untouched by fragility. From the corners of his mouth, the sacred spittle of age sometimes fell to the dust of the earth he had formed. And from that small, unnoticed loss, something ancient and dangerous began to listen. Isis, she who sees beyond the veil of names, she whose mind is said to be more rebellious than a million men and more cunning than a million gods. She watched. Isis did not seek to overthrow Ra through force. No god ever could, not even her. But Isis understood something more dangerous than force. She understood secrets. And she knew that Ra, for all his brilliance, carried within him a hidden key. A name that was not spoken in temple hymns or even carved into obelisks. A name that contained essence itself. Not a title, not a role, but the true utterance of his being. Whoever spoke it would not merely address Ra. They would have power over him. So Isis began her weaving. She moved quietly through the edges of creation until she found what had been discarded without thought, the saliva of Ra, fallen into the dust. She gathered it carefully, reverently, not as waste but as divine residue. Then she mixed it with the earth itself, shaping it with focused intent, breath upon breath, word upon word. And from that mixture, she formed a serpent. Not an ordinary serpent, but a sacred cobra, alive with the stolen essence of the sun god himself. A creature of intelligence, venom, and hidden purpose. Isis placed it along the path where Ra walked each day as he surveyed the world he had made. The world waited, and the serpent waited. When Ra came, the heavens themselves seemed to pause in recognition. The old god walked slowly. His gaze was still vast, still sovereign. He saw the lands that he had shaped, the rivers that he had ordered, the creatures that bore his design, and then, without warning, the serpent struck. The bite wasn't merely physical, it was theological. Venom flooded Ra's being like fire reversing direction, turning light inward upon itself. He staggered, his divine breath fractured, his body, once the source of order, began to tremble with chaos. The gods rushed to him, but there was nothing they could do. For this poison was not from outside creation. It had been made from Ra himself. And therefore, no law of heaven or earth could easily undo it. Ra cried out. The sound was immense, like a thousand dawns collapsing into one scream. His teeth chattered, his limbs shook. The light within him flickered, unstable for the first time since existence began. Across the trembling world, even the stars seemed uncertain. And then, Isis arrived. She didn't rush, and she didn't plead. She didn't bow. She just observed. And when she spoke, her voice carried the calm precision of someone who already knows the ending of the story. "Come," she said. "Tell me your name, Divine Father. For only the one who was called by their true name can be restored." Ra, in agony, tried to hold himself together. And then he spoke. He spoke his great names, the names the world knew, the names sung by priests and carved into temple stone. "I am the maker of heaven and earth," he said. I am the creator of hours. I am the former of days. I am Khepri in the morning, Ra at noon, and Adam in the evening. Each name was radiant. Each name was true. But Isis only watched him burn. And she answered without mercy, but also without deception. That is not your hidden name. Speak it to me, and the poison will leave you. The venom rose higher within him. It reached the threshold where even gods must surrender something deeper than pride. Ra understood then what was being asked. Not a title, not his function, but the core of his being, the name that bound his essence to creation itself. He withdrew from the gaze of the other gods. The world itself seemed to dim in respect, and from the deepest chamber of his divine heart, he allowed it to move outward, a name that had never been spoken, a name that had never been heard, a name that was not sound alone, but power, identity, and origin braided together. He gave it to Isis, and in that moment, something shifted in the structure of reality itself. The poison loosened, the fire within him softened, and Isis, now holding what no god had ever held, became the keeper of a secret that even the sun could not reclaim. Ra was healed, but the cosmos had changed, because from that day forward, even the greatest light was no longer without a hidden vulnerability. And Isis had learned that true power doesn't always come from creation or destruction. Sometimes it comes from knowing the name that lies beneath both. If you're looking for the exact word, spelling, or pronunciation of the secret name, it doesn't exist in any surviving text. The ancient scribes who recorded the myth on the Turin Papyrus intentionally left the actual name unwritten. To write down the absolute true name of the creator god would be to expose the ultimate source of cosmic power to the physical world, which was considered incredibly dangerous and a violation of cosmic order. In the text of the papyrus, the moment Ra grants the name is written with a lacuna or a symbolic omission, stating simply that the name was passed secretly to her heart. So by learning the secret name, Isis achieved two major cosmological victories. Number one, the healing formula. Armed with the name, Isis successfully commanded the venom to leave Ra's body, proclaiming the following, "Flow out, poison. Come forth from Ra. I am the one who works. I am the one who sends away the poison, for Ra has been dispossessed of his name." And then two, the ascension of Horus. Crucially, as a condition for saving his life, Isis forced Ra to swear an oath to yield his supreme heavenly authority to her son, Horus. This myth directly explains how Isis gained the unparalleled magical supremacy that allowed her to protect Horus, defeat Set, and rule as the great of magic before all other deities. To the ancient Egyptians, the story served as the underlying historiola, a mythical precedent for a real-world ritual. If an ordinary Egyptian was bitten by a scorpion or a snake, a magician physician would recite this exact myth over the patient. By chanting how Isis used Ra's secret name to conquer the ultimate divine poison, the magician successfully channeled the exact same cosmic power to draw the physical venom out of the mortal patient's body. Imagine walking into a hospital where the surgeon operating on you is also chanting a spell, and the medicine prescribed to you is activated only when you speak the name of a god. In the ancient world, this wasn't superstition. It was the absolute cutting edge of healthcare. To the people of Kemet, magic wasn't an attempt to break the laws of nature. It was a way of channeling nature's most foundational forces to achieve a physical outcome. This meant that magic and science weren't considered to be enemies. They were partners. Medical papyri from the New Kingdom reveals a society that was deeply invested in clinical observation. scribes meticulously recorded physical symptoms. They mapped out anatomy and engineered practical remedies, demonstrating a sophisticated desire to understand exactly how the human body worked. If you wanted the pinnacle of this dual approach, you would travel to the Great Serapeum of Alexandria, acting as a premier training hospital right next door to the legendary Great Library. The Serapeum became a brilliant crucible of intellect, blending the deep ritualistic medical heritage of Egypt with the rational empirical practices of Greece. So just like today, the medical field was highly specialized. You didn't just see a general doctor, you sought out practitioners with varying levels of competence, looking for the specific healer that's tailored to your affliction. But to truly understand ancient healing, we have to understand how they viewed disease. Sickness wasn't looked at as biological failure. It was pretty much an invasion. The Egyptians believed that illnesses were often caused by malicious spirits or demons known as Aks. Scribes even left behind literal exorcism scripts, including one dramatic spell explicitly written for conjuring the Ak from the belly. This ritual didn't rely on physical medicine alone. It fiercely invoked the protective trinity of Isis, Nephthys, and Horus to drive the spirit out. When massive plagues swept through the land, they weren't blamed on contaminated water, but they were blamed on cosmic wrath. The terrifying plague of the year was seen as the literal breath of Sekhmet, the lioness goddess of destruction, and her invisible army of disease-bearing demons. To survive her wrath, Egyptians weaponized amulets and preventative magic. One popular defensive spell advised weaving a protective linen bandage to wear tightly around the neck. On this fabric, priests would draw the images of Isis, Nephthys, and Osiris. Because these specific deities had been born during the volatile days of the calendar, they possessed the unique inherent cosmic power required to neutralize the year's most deadly dangers. The ancient Egyptian word for doctor was Sunu, and humanity's medical registry included the gods themselves. Deities like Isis, Thoth, and Horus were all revered as celestial Sunu. While any god could technically be invoked in a crisis, the divine realm had its own strict medical board and areas of specialization. For instance, because the terrifying lioness Sekhmet commanded the demons of pestilence, she was also the only one who could call them off. Consequently, her priests and priestesses became highly specialized, and they were fiercely sought after medical experts renowned throughout the ancient world, mainly for their deep understanding of epidemiology and plague management. Yet, if you were a patient looking for pure compassion and unparalleled magical efficacy, you called upon Isis. Why was she such an extraordinary healer? Maybe it's because she had the ultimate resume. She had countless hours of emergency practices, saving her own son Horus from that brink of death, giving her a vast, unmatched store of medical and magical intelligence. As one ancient text beautifully records, her speech is the breath of life. Her utterance removes suffering, and her words restore the one with an oppressed threat to life. Isis wasn't a detached deity. Her greatest delight was quite literally to bestow cures on mankind. Isis was a master synthesizer of cosmic knowledge. The god of intellect Thoth, who in some traditions actually taught Isis the medical arts, he frequently acted as her consultant, stepping in with celestial formulas whenever a cure seemed just out of her reach. Furthermore, Geb, the primordial earth god who held dominion over all slithering things, gifted Isis the specific heavy secrets that are needed to repulse poison. On the Metternich Stela, Isis herself confidently boasts of this inherited power, proclaiming that she is forever, quote, driving away reptiles, and every reptile who stings listens to me. Everyone, this is only part one of the goddess Isis or goddess Aset. There are many more episodes to come, given that she was a goddess for over 3,000 years. That's 3,000 years worth of content to review and to synthesize. So I look forward to bringing you more episodes that are coming up shortly. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and I will be connecting with you soon. Everybody, take care of yourselves. Bye-bye.